Welcome to the Deep Dive, your ultimate shortcut to being profoundly well-informed without ever feeling swamped by information overload. I'm Alex Smith, and today we are plunging into a truly fascinating, if often overlooked, document. The Federal Register for Monday, August 18th, 2025.
And I'm Taylor Johnson. For those of you who might not be familiar, the Federal Register is, well, it's more than just a dusty government document.
Definitely more.
It's the daily chronicle of how our nation is governed. It's where federal agencies, departments, organizations officially announce their new rules, propose future regulations, and post various notices.
Right.
You'll also find executive orders and other presidential documents here. Think of it as the central nervous system of federal administration, where the actual mechanics of governance, the nitty-gritty details that shape our lives, are formally unveiled.
That's precisely right. And our mission today is to go far beyond simply listing these entries. We want to genuinely unpack their significance, to explore the often hidden why it matters, and to project the potential ripple effects of these regulations and announcements.
Exactly. It's essentially a fast track to understanding how government actions, from the seemingly mundane to the overtly impactful, touch everything from the safety of your next flight to, well, the food on your dinner table, the products you buy, and even the intricate dance of our financial markets.
Absolutely. It is an enormous volume of information published every single business day. Trying to navigate it on your own would be like trying to drink from a fire hose, really.
Oh, absolutely. But don't worry. We've sifted through today's edition for you. We'll distill the most important nuggets, ensuring you're comprehensively well-informed without feeling, you know, overwhelmed by the sheer volume or the bureaucratic language.
Okay, so let's begin this deep dive.
Yeah.
Diving into the rules shaping regulations and safety standards. Our journey begins in a section of the Federal Register called CFR Parts Affected. Think of this as a concise index, sort of a table of contents for federal regulations. The very first item listed is a presidential memorandum from August 4, 2025, referenced on page 40033. Now, it's not the full text, just a reference. So what exactly does this kind of entry signify? Is it merely a placeholder, or does it tell us something deeper about presidential actions and how they're recorded?
That's a crucial observation, and it reveals a lot about the Federal Register's multifaceted role. While the Register is indeed the official source for the full text of most rules and proposed rules, this specific entry for the presidential memorandum only serves as a reference point.
Okay.
It's indicating the document's presence in a larger, full compilation of presidential documents, rather than detailing its specific content within this particular daily edition of the Federal Register. So it functions like a critical bookmark, you could say.
A bookmark, I like that.
Yeah. It tells us that an official presidential action took place on August 4th, 2025, and that it has been formally incorporated into the administrative record of the U.S. government.
I see. So it's like a formal flag planted in the ground, signaling something significant happened, a bit like a headline saying presidential action taken, without laying out the entire article right here.
Exactly.
We know it exists, it's officially part of the public record, and it has legal force, but to read its full content, we'd need to go to that full 414 page in the larger compilation, which unfortunately isn't included in our source material for today's deep dive. So we're focusing on the fact of its existence and its place in the federal record.
Precisely.
Now, let's turn our attention skyward to the Federal Aviation Administration, FAA. They've just issued special conditions for a specific aircraft. Jet Aviation AG and Gulfstream Aerospace Corporation's Model GVI airplane. This is all about the installation of a therapeutic oxygen system. This sounds like the FAA is grappling with some cutting-edge technology here.
Precisely. This entry truly highlights the FAA's incredibly proactive role in anticipating and responding to new aviation technologies, often before they become widespread. They've identified what they call a novel or unusual design feature.
Oh.
In this instance, it's an oxygen distribution system that provides a shared source of oxygen intended for both the flight crew and passengers for supplemental and therapeutic use.
Right.
The challenge here is that the existing airworthiness standards, the foundational rules designed to ensure aircraft safety, were simply not written with this kind of dual-purpose shared source system in mind. They don't have adequate or appropriate safety provisions to cover such an innovation.
So because the technology is literally flying ahead of the rulebook, the FAA steps in with these special conditions. This shared source of oxygen for both pilots and passengers immediately brings up safety concerns. What are the fundamental safety considerations when you have one oxygen source serving such diverse and critical needs?
That's a crucial point. and it's at the heart of the FAA's concern. Traditionally, flight crew oxygen systems are entirely separate from passenger systems, creating, you know, a clear redundancy. A shared system could certainly streamline operations and potentially reduce weight or complexity in certain areas of the aircraft's design. However, as you rightly identified, it introduces new failure modes or distribution challenges that weren't anticipated by older, more compartmentalized regulations.
Like, what if there's a problem with that one source?
Exactly. How do you prioritize critical life support for the pilots who are flying the aircraft versus therapeutic needs for passengers? The special conditions are the FAA's very specific answer to this. They are establishing an equivalent level of safety. That's a key phrase.
Equivalent level of safety. Got it.
To what would be provided by existing standards, but they're doing it by implementing very specific additional design requirements for this dual purpose installation. These requirements ensure it meets the highest safety benchmarks, even with a novel design.
And this rule is effective now.
It's effective for Jet Aviation AG as of August 15th, 2025. But it's also important that they're still seeking public comments until September 29, 2025. So there's a window for feedback.
Okay.
And quite significantly, if Jet Aviation AG tries to apply this exact same innovative feature to any other Gulfstream models under Type Certificate NO-00015AT, these special conditions would automatically apply to those aircraft as well.
Ah, so it sets a precedent.
It does, setting a clear precedent for future integrations of similar systems.
So this isn't just a one-off for a single plane. It could truly impact a whole line of similar aircraft, setting a new innovative standard for onboard medical systems and how they're regulated. It truly shows the FAA constantly adapting to the rapid pace of new aerospace designs.
Exactly right.
Our next item takes us to the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, and it's a critical development in the ongoing fight against the opioid crisis. The DEA is issuing a temporary scheduling order for two new benzimidazole opioids, specifically N-pyrrolidino metonidazine and N-pyrrolidino protonidazine. What's the real power of this temporary action? How quickly can it happen? And what does that mean for how the opioid crisis is fought on the ground?
This is a direct and absolutely necessary response to the relentless and frankly terrifying evolution of the opioid crisis. These substances are synthetic opioids, commonly referred to as nitazenes.
Nitazenes, okay.
They first made their appearance on the recreational drug market as recently as 2019, which tells you how quickly new variants can emerge, often engineered to bypass existing drug law.
Oh, that's recent.
Very. Their pharmacological profile is alarmingly similar to highly potent and extremely dangerous substances like fentanyl and morphine, which, as we know, have been responsible for so many overdose deaths across the nation. The critical difference here is the temporary scheduling. This isn't just a procedural tweak. It's the government's fastest legal tool to get these poisons off the market.
That's fascinating. The source mentions the DEA has already temporarily controlled 10 other benzimidazole opioids between August 2020 and March 2024. It sounds like a constant game of catch-up. How challenging is it for agencies like the DEA to stay ahead of these rapidly evolving threats?
You've hit on the core challenge. It is a constant game of catch-up, but with incredibly high stakes. Drug traffickers are constantly tweaking molecular structures to create new substances that aren't yet scheduled, hoping to operate in a legal gray area. And what specifically makes these two, N-pyrrolidino metonidazine and N-pyrrolidino protonidazine, so concerning right now? Law enforcement data clearly shows they are already being abused across the U.S. This isn't a theoretical threat. It's an active public health emergency.
We have data on that.
We do. Since 2023, there have been 123 exhibits reported to the NFLIS drug database. That's the National Forensic Laboratory Information System, specifically related to their trafficking and abuse. For metonidazine, there were 10 encounters identified in four states, Florida, Maine, Missouri, and Ohio.
Okay.
And for protonidazine, the data shows 113 exhibits. That indicates a pretty significant presence and spread already.
Wow.
So the DEA's power to issue these temporary scheduling orders under 21 USC 811H is absolutely critical in this context. Unlike permanent scheduling, which involves a formal rulemaking process, often extensive judicial review, a much slower process.
That takes time.
A lot of time. These temporary orders can be issued very quickly by order rather than by rule. This means they can bypass the typical notice and comment requirements of the Administrative Procedure Act.
So they can act fast.
Extremely fast. This procedural flexibility allows the DEA to act swiftly when there's an imminent threat to public safety, which is essential given the rapidly changing nature of the illicit drug market and the lethal potency of these substances. Imagine the time it would take for a full legislative process. Lives would be lost.
No question.
This temporary scheduling power is literally the government's fastest legal tool here. It's a stark example of the government choosing speed over extended deliberation when public health hangs in the balance. A necessary trade-off, really.
So this ability to fast-track the legal status of these substances, bypassing the typical lengthy review, sounds incredibly powerful. What are the broader implications of that kind of expedited action for public health?
Well, the implications are profound and immediate. This rapid response capability is absolutely vital given the extreme potency and danger posed by these new synthetic opioids.
Mm-hmm.
The DEA's ability to move with such agility is a direct measure to prevent further harm and overdose fatalities from these specific compounds. It allows them to close dangerous loopholes that traffickers previously exploited.
Before they get a real foothold.
Exactly. Preventing the substances from gaining a foothold in the illicit market before legal action could be taken. It's also notable that the DEA determined this decision is not considered a significant regulatory action.
What does that mean, practically?
It means it doesn't require review by the Office of Management and Budget, nor does it have substantial direct effects on states or federalism implications. This further streamlines the process, allowing for more agile action in what is, without question, a pressing public health emergency. It reflects a framework designed to prioritize speed when lives are at stake.
Now let's explore an area that, while maybe less traumatic, is equally vital to millions of Americans, their financial future. The Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, or PBGC, has several amendments to its pension regulations. Sounds technical, but crucial for protecting those retirement plans.
That's absolutely right. The PBGC functions much like an insurance company for private pension plans. Think of it as the quiet safety net underneath.
Right.
These updates, most effective August 15th, 2025, are all about keeping those protections robust, relevant, and aligned with current law. They ensure that if a company's pension plan fails, retirees don't suddenly lose everything.
That's essential.
It is. It's important to note that most of these amendments are either clarifications or they conform to statutory changes already passed by Congress, like the SECURE Act.
Okay.
Because of this, the PBGC has certified that these specific amendments won't have a significant economic impact on small entities, which is often a key concern.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. There are several specific changes. The source highlights updates to the definition of a new plan. What's changing there and why is that important?
This is an interesting but necessary detail for, well, administrative clarity and flexibility. Essentially, the PBGC is clarifying how new pension plans are defined for paying premiums.
Rousseau.
Previously, a new plan was one that did not exist before the premium payment year. Now it's changing to a plan with an effective date during the premium payment year. This change directly accounts for provisions in the SECURE Act.
Ah, connecting to other legislation.
Exactly. The SECURE Act lets employers treat newly adopted plans as having been adopted in the prior tax year. This offers more flexibility in setting up and funding plans, so the PBGC rule needs to reflect that.
Makes sense.
They also added a specific definition for the premium funding target of a CSC's plan, which relates to its liability based only on vested benefits already earned. Adds precision.
And what about how companies actually pay into these plans? Changes to premium due dates?
Yes, they are clarifying premium filing due dates. This is actually about returning to standard procedures. For 2025, the due dates were earlier due to a specific provision in the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015.
Temporary thing.
Right. But for 2026 and going forward, the PBGC is reincorporating the standard, more consistent premium filing rules. This ensures clarity year to year once that temporary provision expires. Helps plan administrators know exactly when payments are due.
And what happens when a pension plan terminates? Are there updates to that crucial process?
Indeed. The updates touch on the termination of single employer plans. This section details the rigorous process for plans with enough assets to terminate in what's called a standard termination.
What does that involve?
It lays out strict requirements. Administrators must notify all participants, provide detailed benefit info, file specifics with the PBGC, and then, assuming PBGC gives the okay, distribute all the assets to cover benefits. It's highly structured to protect beneficiaries.
Okay.
They are also modifying rules around reportable events, specifically clarifying when the PBGC doesn't need notice of a change in a contributing sponsor. This applies if the change doesn't actually affect the plan's controlled group, basically, if the overall ownership structure around the plan stays the same.
Streamlining reporting a bit.
Exactly. Without compromising oversight. They're also removing a specific sentence from the regulations, presumably redundant, just tidying up.
It really does sound like a lot of meticulous tidying up and alignment of the rule book with current realities and legislative changes, all designed to make a very complex system run more smoothly.
Precisely. For example, in the rules on allocation of assets in single employer plans, they're referencing a June 2024 final rule that updated critical assumptions for valuing benefits, things like interest rates, mortality tables, expenses.
Those sound important.
Very. These updated assumptions are also used for calculating multi-employer withdrawal liability, which is a big deal for companies leaving those plans. And then in the rules concerning duties of plan sponsor following mass withdrawal, they're making a conforming change, meaning
Right.
they're updating terminology. The benefit valuation regulation no longer uses the term benefit liabilities in certain places, so they're removing a reference that required substituting terms, ensures consistency across regulations.
Got it.
While these might seem like minor technical updates, they are absolutely vital. They ensure the PBGC's oversight remains effective and aligned with current law and practices, ultimately protecting the pensions of millions of Americans.
So we've seen rules adapting for high-tech planes, dangerous drugs, and safeguarding retirements. But what about something completely new, like an offshore concert? How does the government ensure safety when the stage is literally floating? Let's turn to the Coast Guard, part of Homeland Security. They've issued a temporary final rule for a special local regulation in Casco Bay, Maine.
This is a fascinating and very tangible example of how regulations are designed to be nimble and adaptable to specific temporary events. The Coast Guard is setting up this special local regulation with a clear purpose, ensuring the safety of both spectators on boats and other mariners in Casco Bay.
Because a big crowd on the water is risky.
Exactly. Large crowds, even on boats, can create dangerous situations if not managed properly. Collisions, capsizing, you name it.
So what specific, almost military precision measures are they putting in place for this concert? Sounds like controlling all those boats could be quite an undertaking.
The regulation is quite detailed. It's effective from 12:30 p.m. on August 16th, 2025, through 5:30 p.m. on August 17th, though mainly enforced on the 16th unless weather delays it.
Okay.
It creates a temporary spectator area around Cow Island. Within this area, they're prohibiting swimming crucial and open water around boats and setting up a speed restriction oh-no wake zone to keep speed safe and prevent disruptive wakes.
Makes sense.
What's particularly important, though, are the two designated safe access lanes. Each lane is 240 feet wide, pretty substantial.
Like a highway on the water.
Kind of, yeah. One lane runs parallel to the concert stage barge across the whole spectator zone. The second runs down the center, perpendicular to the stage. These lanes are absolutely critical for allowing vessels to safely enter and exit, and even more importantly, provide clear, unobstructed access for emergency response boats.
For Coast Guard, fireboats.
Exactly. Coast Guard patrols, fireboats, medical aid, whatever might be needed in an incident. It's really a blueprint for managing crowds on the water safely.
It's incredibly smart to have clear routes for emergencies in what could be a very crowded space. Why did this rule need to be effective so quickly, rather than going through a longer public comment period? Seems like a theme when dealing with immediate needs.
You're right, it is. The Coast Guard used a good cause exemption, allowed under federal law, specifically 5 U.S.C. 553, to make this rule effective in less than 30 days.
You got it.
Because delaying it would have made the rule pointless. It literally needed to be in place by August 16th for the concert itself. Without the speed, the concert might have been canceled or proceeded without adequate safety rules, a huge risk.
Right.
This highlights the agility agencies can use for immediate, time-sensitive safety needs, as long as it aligns with the law. It also doesn't require new information collection under the Paperwork Reduction Act, and it's consistent with federalism principles, doesn't unduly impact state or local authority, all factors allowing for quick implementation.
A great example of bureaucracy being nimble when safety demands it.
Exactly. Two, environmental and health protections, from air to food to wildlife.
Moving now to environmental and health protections, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has announced an extension of deadlines for several important air quality regulations. This covers the oil and natural gas sector climate review and standards for hazardous air pollutants from iron and steel manufacturing and coke ovens. Sounds like a balancing act between industry and environmental goals.
It absolutely is, and it's a constant one. These extensions, listed across four different docket IDs, relate to truly critical standards for industries that are historically major sources of air pollution.
Right.
The very fact that deadlines are being extended signals potential challenges or complexities in implementing these standards, maybe for the industries complying, or perhaps for the EPA itself in refining or enforcing them.
A real tension there.
It represents a real tension between industry readiness and vital environmental protection goals. Industries need time to adapt complex operations, but public health and environmental quality are also at stake.
What exactly are hazardous air pollutants, or HAPs, and why the focus on these specific sectors like oil and gas, iron, and steel? Are we talking about everyday smog or something more serious?
We're talking about something far more serious than everyday smog, yeah.
Huh.
HAPs are a category known or suspected to cause cancer or other serious health effects, like birth defects or severe environmental damage. These aren't just minor irritants. They pose significant long-term health risks.
Okay.
Industries like oil and gas production, integrated iron and steel manufacturing, and coke ovens are historically significant emitters of these pollutants. Coke ovens, for instance, release a nasty cocktail, including benzene and formaldehyde.
Yikes.
Yeah. The sheer scale and nature of their processes make them major sources. The climate review aspect of the oil and gas rule also points to broader efforts to regulate greenhouse gases, showing that intersection between air quality and climate policy.
And they're transparent about this.
Well, it's worth noting the EPA's policy is to include all public comments in the public docket, even personal info, unless it's claimed as confidential business information or restricted. This ensures transparency, even when extensions are granted.
So transparency is key, even with deadline extensions for regulations impacting our health and environment. Sounds like there's a lot of public interest and scrutiny here.
And for good reason.
Sticking with the EPA, they've also established a pesticide tolerance for mandipropamid on papaya. For many of us, pesticides on food are a concern. So how exactly does the EPA decide what's safe when it comes to residues on our food?
That's an excellent and very important question. Under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, the FFDCA, the EPA, can only set a tolerance, that's the maximum permissible level of a residue, if they determine there's a reasonable certainty that no harm will result from aggregate exposure to that pesticide.
Aggregate exposure, what does that cover?
It's comprehensive. It's not just the food you eat directly. It includes potential exposure through drinking water and even in residential settings, like from pesticides used around your home.
Huh?
This specific regulation, effective August 15th, 2025, sets the limit for mandipropamid on papaya at a very precise 0.9 parts per million. That number comes from extensive scientific analysis.
That's quite specific. But what about special considerations for vulnerable groups, like infants and children? Do they get extra protection?
This is where it gets particularly insightful, and it highlights a critical part of U.S. food safety law. The FFDCA requires the EPA to apply an additional tenfold safety factor, a 10x margin, specifically for infants and children for certain effects.
10 times. Wow.
Yes. It's known as the Food Quality Protection Act, or FQPA safety factor. Its purpose is to account for potential prenatal and postnatal toxicity and to compensate for any gaps in the toxicity data for a pesticide.
Kids can be more vulnerable, you know,
yeah.
Smaller bodies, developing organs.
In this particular case, the EPA determined that mandipropamid does not have a common mechanism of toxicity with other substances. That's important because if it did, they might have to consider cumulative effects, which could change how that safety factor is applied.
And there's still time for feedback.
Yes. The public has until October 14th, 2025, to submit objections and requests for hearings. So even after a decision, there's a window for scrutiny.
So a very careful, science-driven balancing act, especially for the youngest consumers. Good to know.
Definitely.
Now to the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APAS. They have rules about user fees for certain aircraft, specifically exempting some from inspection fees. Seems minor, but these fees fund vital biosecurity.
It's true. It's a policy designed to fine-tune fee collection, aiming to make it truly commensurate with the costs of the AQI services, the inspection services.
Okay.
The rule, signed August 8th, 2025, introduces specific exemptions. It exempts aircraft with 70 or fewer seats arriving from foreign places into the continental U.S., Alaska, or Hawaii.
But there are conditions, right?
Oh, yes. This exemption only applies if these smaller aircraft are not carrying specific agricultural products, fresh fruits, veggies, plants, certain meats, etc., and if they don't offer full meal service, just beverages and prepackaged snacks without restricted ingredients. It's targeted to reduce fees for less risky, smaller operations.
So targeting smaller, limited operations.
Yeah.
But what's that garbage handling requirements clause mean? Even if they're exempt from the fee, those rules still apply. Sounds like even a half-eaten sandwich could be a security issue.
You've hit on it perfectly, and it's not far from the truth. Even if an aircraft is exempt from the user fee, it is still subject to very strict garbage handling requirements under the regulations.
Why is that so critical?
It's absolutely critical for preventing pests and diseases from entering the U.S. Imagine a single fruit fly, an invasive seed, or a microbe hitching a ride in discarded airplane food. That seemingly harmless bit of garbage, yes, even a fruit peel could introduce something that devastates an entire agricultural sector or ecosystem here.
So it really is serious.
Absolutely. It's the unsung hero of your morning orange juice, really, that we inspect airline trash. Oh. So it's a nuanced approach. Reduce financial burden where appropriate, but never compromise on biosecurity.
Next, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC, has issued an interim enforcement policy. This one's about enforcement discretion for general licensee adoption of certificate of compliance holder-generated changes.
Mm.
Sounds technical, but it raises a question. Why would the NRC need enforcement discretion? Wouldn't you want absolute strict compliance in nuclear energy?
That's a crucial and insightful question, and it goes to the heart of practical regulation in a high-stakes field. This is a nuanced but important regulatory tool. It allows the NRC to exercise a certain level of discretion in enforcing specific violations that might occur when a general licensee, that's typically a plant operator, adopts changes generated by a certificate of compliance or COSI holder. The COSI holder is usually a design certifier or vendor whose components or systems have already been reviewed and approved by the NRC.
So they're using pre-approved stuff. Why the discretion then?
The need for discretion comes from the reality that implementing complex changes, even approved ones, can sometimes lead to minor technical deviations from strict compliance. Maybe a licensee, acting in good faith to enhance safety, implements a change from a COSI holder, but the process or some aspect technically falls slightly outside the rules, leading to a violation.
Okay, I see.
This interim enforcement policy, or IEP, effective August 15th, 2025, provides necessary flexibility. It signals the NRC values cooperation and encourages adopting these pre-certified improvements. It allows for minor deviations without immediate punishment as long as overall safety isn't compromised.
So it encourages using the best practices without being overly punitive for tiny slip-ups.
Exactly. It's about balancing rigid adherence with practical, safe implementation in a complex environment where absolute perfection in every detail might be unachievable, but overall safety is paramount.
That makes perfect sense, maintaining safety without stifling necessary improvements.
Precisely.
Now to a proposed rule from the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, part of NOAA. This concerns incidental take authorization for harbor seals during construction in the Duckabush Estuary Restoration Project in Washington. Sounds like a tricky balance. Ecological restoration versus protecting wildlife.
It absolutely is, and it's a fascinating case study in environmental management. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, USC, is seeking this authorization for a vital restoration project in the Duckabush Estuary. This estuary is critical for harbor seals.
Why does it need restoring?
The project aims to restore the estuary because it was severely altered by Highway 101 construction back in the early 1900s. The highway basically cut across the intertidal delta, disrupting tidal flow, blocking fish access, and causing a decline in essential mudflats and salt marshes. So the long-term goal is very positive ecologically.
So the project is good for the environment long-term, but the construction might still impact marine life during the process. Bit of a paradox.
Exactly. NMFS proposes to authorize what's called Level B harassment of harbor seals from the local Hood Canal stock. Think of it as significant behavioral disturbance, loud noises from pile driving or human presence might make seals change behavior, maybe move away quickly, or even flush into the water from their haul-out spots.
But no injuries.
Critically, the authorization does not anticipate or propose to authorize any injuries or mortalities. The maximum estimated take in terms of this Level B harassment is capped at 480 harbor seals in any one year. That limit ensures the disturbance stays within an acceptable threshold relative to the population.
That's a clear distinction.
Mm.
How do they plan to minimize that impact on such a sensitive species during construction, and how do they monitor it?
They have incredibly robust and fascinating mitigation measures and monitoring requirements. The USEC must hire qualified protected species observers, or PSOs.
What do they do?
These PSOs must be independent of the construction contractor, no conflict of interest, and have no other tasks during monitoring. Their sole focus is marine mammals. They conduct pre-start clearance monitoring for 30 minutes before any pile driving begins, ensuring designated shutdown zones around the construction are clear.
and during pupping season.
Even stricter rules. During pupping season, August 1st through October 31st, construction cannot even begin within 300 meters of a mom pup pair hauled out on land, or within 100 meters if they're in the water. Very specific protection for the most vulnerable.
That's incredibly detailed. And how do they track the actual impact? What data are these PSOs collecting?
The PSOs record incredibly detailed environmental conditions, weather, tides, visibility, etc., things that affect behavior and visibility. They meticulously document the number of each species, their location, distance from construction, status in water or hauled out, and behavior.
Wow.
They also do hourly counts. The reports distinguish between minor behavioral changes, level one, not take, and significant movements or flushing, levels two and three, which are take.
And the overall conclusion?
The overall determination by NMFS is that the project will have a negligible impact on the harbor seal population. Why? Because the effects are localized and temporary, and importantly, the restoration itself is expected to have a significant long-term beneficial effect on the seal's habitat and prey availability. Short-term, minimal disturbance for long-term ecological gain.
Makes sense. A necessary trade-off, carefully managed.
Exactly. Three, government operations, data, and economic activity.
Moving now to the Department of Defense, specifically the Army, they've announced the availability of a final environmental impact statement for actions at the Military Ocean Terminal Sunny Point, or MOTSU, in North Carolina. Sounds like crucial infrastructure work for national security.
It is indeed. MOTSU is a truly vital military installation on the East Coast, a strategic ammunition port crucial for national security. It's where a significant amount of munitions and equipment are loaded and unloaded for deployment.
So what are they planning to do?
The proposed actions planned for fiscal years 2026 through 2031 are about modernizing and maintaining critical infrastructure, improving barricade safety for explosives, maintaining the waterfront, enhancing security for the Pleasure Island Explosive Safety Clear Zone, that's a safety buffer, and upgrading infrastructure like roads, rail, utilities, and fire breaks. It's comprehensive.
Ensuring the facility is safe, secure, and effective.
Exactly. Directly supporting military readiness.
It sounds like essential upgrades. What's the environmental aspect, given it's a final environmental impact statement? Are they making concessions for national security?
That's a keen observation, and it highlights a critical tension. What's fascinating here is the explicit inclusion of a final finding of no practicable alternative, or AFFONN PA.
AFFONN PA.
Yes. It's a significant legal and environmental determination required under executive orders for floodplain management and wetland protection. It's needed because parts of the proposed work at MOTSU will occur in floodplains or involve construction in wetlands-sensitive areas.
So what does the FONNPA mean?
It means that after an exhaustive environmental review, the Army determined there's no other practical or feasible way to achieve its mission-critical improvements, these essential national security upgrades, without impacting these specific sensitive areas. It highlights that inherent tension between national security needs and environmental protection.
So they acknowledge the trade-off.
Exactly. And it shows how agencies navigate it, ensuring thorough reviews even when there's no ideal alternative that avoids sensitive ecosystems. Mitigation efforts are still required, of course.
That makes sense. Necessary trade-off, but transparently reviewed.
Right.
The Department of Defense has also submitted a proposal for collection of information to the Office of Management and Budget for Clearance under the Paperwork Reduction Act. Sounds very bureaucratic. Why should we care about information collection clearance?
It might sound bureaucratic, but it's actually important. It touches on government efficiency and the burden on the public. The Paperwork Reduction Act aims to minimize the reporting and record-keeping burden from federal information collections.
So every time they ask for info.
Right. Every time an agency asks a business or individual for info on a form, survey, application that's a collection of information, this act ensures they only collect necessary data efficiently without undue burden.
And this specific collection?
The notice doesn't detail what info they're collecting here. It could be surveys, compliance reporting, operational data, but its submission indicates an ongoing need for data within DOD. The key is that public comments are open until September 15th, 2025.
So there's public input.
Yes. Even for seemingly routine administrative steps, there's a mechanism for input to ensure the collection is necessary and the burden minimized.
Yeah.
It's about accountability and preventing unnecessary red tape.
The Department of Education has two significant notices about information collection. First, an extension of a currently approved information collection request related to Student Assistance General Provisions Non-Title IV Revenue Requirements, also known as the 90-10 rule. What's the core problem this rule tackles in higher ed?
This is absolutely critical for understanding the financial integrity and accountability of higher education institutions, especially for-profit colleges. Title IV funds are federal student aid dollars, Pell Grants, federal loans, work study.
Right, the money students get.
Exactly. The 90-10 rule is designed to prevent for-profit colleges from relying excessively on these federal funds. It stops them from just being federal aid pipelines with no real market demand.
Ow.
It requires them to get at least 10% of their revenue from non-federal sources. This ensures they have some market viability beyond direct government subsidies. It prevents taxpayer dollars from propping up institutions that might not be providing value.
And they're extending the data collection for this?
Yes, extending it without change. This means the department is currently satisfied with the existing data collection method to monitor compliance. Suggests the current reporting works. Public comments are invited until October 14th, 2025.
So, ensuring these schools have a real market base. And the second education item is about the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System, or IPEs. What's the broader purpose of this data system?
This raises the question, how do we get comprehensive, standardized data on colleges and universities nationwide? IPEs is the primary, most vital source for that.
Okay.
It's a system of surveys conducted annually by the National Center for Education Statistics. Collects data from all post-secondary institutions participating in federal aid programs. Think of it as the ultimate statistical snapshot of higher ed enrollment, graduation rates, faculty salaries, financial aid, everything.
Who uses this data?
It's invaluable for students and parents making choices, for policymakers assessing higher ed's health, and for researchers studying trends.
And they're proposing changes to how they collect it.
Yes, proposing a revision. Their aim is twofold. First, assess impact and minimize the reporting burden on institutions recognizing the effort involved. Second, enhance the data's quality, utility, and clarity.
Making it better and easier.
Pretty much. They specifically want feedback on the time burden for institutions, showing they're mindful of the administrative load. Comments are also due by October 14, 2025. Ensures the system evolves usefully without overburdening schools.
Shifting now to energy regulation. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has a public notice about records governing off-the-record communications. This sounds like it's about the integrity of decisions. What are off-the-record communications, and why regulate them?
That's a great question, and yes, it speaks directly to the integrity and fairness of regulatory decisions, especially in complex areas like energy projects. Off-the-record communications are basically contacts discussions, submissions between interested parties, like industry reps, advocates, landowners, and the decision makers at FERC that happen outside the formal public record.
So secret lobbying attempts?
Potentially, yeah. Trying to influence a decision without everyone else seeing the conversation. FERC's rules, highlighted here, are very clear. If a communication is deemed prohibited off the record, it will not be considered in the decision.
That's critical.
Absolutely. However, parties can request a chance to respond to facts in such a communication if fairness requires it. Ensures potentially impactful info, even if improperly submitted, can be addressed publicly.
So it maintains transparency.
Exactly. It's a mechanism to ensure all inputs are transparent, documented, and subject to scrutiny. Vital for public trust in high-stakes energy matters involving huge projects, environmental impacts, and big money. The notice gives deadlines for comments on a specific project, CP25-535-000, by September 2nd, and encourages using their e-comment feature.
And it's good they have an Office of Public Participation to help people navigate this.
Definitely helps with accessibility.
Back to the EPA. They've issued statements of findings for certain new chemicals or significant new uses under the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA. Sounds like getting ahead of potential problems.
It is exactly that. This is fascinating because it's proactive regulation of chemicals before they enter the market or when their use changes significantly. Under TSCA, manufacturers must submit pre-manufacture notices, PMNs, for new chemicals.
And if the use changes,
they submit significant new use notices, or SNUNs. The EPA reviews these to assess risks to health and the environment, toxicity, environmental fate, everything. As this notice for June 2025 shows, they publish these statements of findings when a new chemical or use is found not likely to present an unreasonable risk.
So it vets them first.
Exactly. This pre-market review helps prevent harm by catching problems early rather than reacting after a chemical causes issues. But it also streamlines introducing chemicals deemed safe, balancing innovation with protection, ensures chemicals and everyday products have been vetted.
The Federal Reserve System has a notice about formations of, acquisitions by, and mergers of bank holding companies. Why is the Fed so involved in approving these financial deals?
This raises important questions about financial stability and market concentration in banking. Under the Bank Holding Company Act and the Fed's Regulation Y, actions creating or expanding bank holding companies, forming new ones, acquiring banks, merging need prior Fed approval.
It's not just rubber stamping.
Not at all. These applications get rigorous review. The Fed assesses impact on competition. Will it create a monopoly? Financial system stability, too big to fail, too risky. And public convenience and needs. Will it improve banking services?
Okay.
The constant flow of these notices shows how dynamic the financial sector is and the Fed's continuous role in overseeing and shaping its structure to keep it sound, competitive, and serving the broader economy. It underpins stability.
From the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, a general notice that vessel sanitation inspection fees from fiscal year 2025 will continue into 2026. Sounds like an essential public health measure for travelers.
It is absolutely directly related to public health for millions, especially cruise travelers. The CDC's vessel sanitation program is a critical defense against illnesses like norovirus outbreaks on cruise ships.
How does it work?
Its mandate is minimizing risk. They do this through robust inspections. Every vessel with a foreign itinerary and 13-plus passengers gets twice yearly unannounced inspections, plus re-inspections if needed.
Unannounced is key.
Definitely. Keeps ships ready all the time, not just for scheduled visits. The continuation of these fees ensures the program has consistent funding for these essential oversight activities. Without it, they couldn't do the inspections protecting millions from health risks, a vital, if often unseen, public health effort.
The National Institutes of Health, NIH, has notices for several meetings of scientific review panels, one from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, another from the National Cancer Institute. Seems procedural, but these are gatekeepers for medical breakthroughs. What happens in these meetings? How do they ensure we fund the next big discovery?
You've hit on a critical point. These virtual meetings, scheduled for late September 2025, are essentially the engine of medical discovery in the U.S. Scientific review panels are like, well, a scientific shark tank, but without the drama.
Okay.
They're composed of top researchers and experts who meticulously, often blindly, without knowing the applicant's identity, to prevent bias, evaluate grant applications from researchers nationwide. Their rigorous process decides which projects get crucial federal funding.
So they pick the best science.
Exactly. Ensures taxpayer dollars go to the most promising, scientifically sound, rigorously designed studies in critical areas like drug abuse and cancer research. The emphasis is on merit, innovation, potential impact. Is the science sound? Is the question compelling? Is the methodology robust? Will it advance understanding or lead to new treatments?
Right.
The continuous cycle of these meetings reflects the ongoing commitment to advancing health sciences and improving human health. It's foundational to our nation's scientific enterprise, constantly vetting the next wave of discoveries. 4, trade, sanctions, and social programs.
The Foreign Agricultural Service, part of USDA, has a notice about adjustment of appendices under the dairy tariff rate quota import licensing regulation. Sounds wonky, but could change which dairy products hit our shelves.
You're right. It's technical but impactful for the dairy industry and trade. It announces the transfer of specific dairy articles from the historical license category to the lottery non-historical license category for the 2025 quota year.
Okay, what are tariff rate quotas and how does this transfer from historical to lottery work? Who benefits?
Tariff rate quotas, or TRQs, are common trade tools. They allow a specific quantity of goods here, dairy articles, to be imported at a lower tariff rate. Imports above that quota face much higher tariffs.
A two-tiered system.
Exactly. Manages import volumes, protects domestic industries, fulfills trade obligations. Historical licenses go to importers based on past performance. If you imported a lot before, you get a slice of the low tariff pie.
And lottery.
Lottery licenses open opportunities to new entrants or those without a historical track record, distributed by random drawing.
So this adjustment shifts access.
Yes. Effective August 15th, 2025, access to importing certain dairy items at the lower rate is shifting. It potentially allows new businesses into the market, fostering competition, maybe more diverse products, or it could change the landscape for existing importers, could affect supply chains, maybe availability or pricing for consumers. A dynamic mechanism.
Now to the Department of Commerce, Enforcement, and Compliance. Multiple significant notices on anti-dumping and countervailing duty investigations, protecting U.S. industries from unfair trade practices.
Spot on. These duties are crucial tools. Imposed when foreign governments unfairly subsidize industries, that's countervailing duties, or when foreign companies sell goods here below fair value dumping, that's anti-dumping duties. Both harm domestic producers.
Let's start with Sol-Gel alumina-based ceramic abrasive grains from China. What did Commerce find?
For these abrasive grains, Commerce made a final affirmative determination that China is providing countervailable subsidies. These grains are technical minimum 94% aluminum oxide used in grinding, cutting, polishing.
Okay.
Commerce set specific subsidy rates for named Chinese companies and an all others category, often based on facts otherwise available if companies don't cooperate fully.
What happens next?
Commerce notifies the International Trade Commission, ITC. The ITC then has 45 days to determine if the U.S. industry is materially injured or threatened by these subsidized imports. If yes, the duties are finalized and imposed, levels the playing field.
So, impacting U.S. abrasive manufacturers' competitiveness, what about overhead door springs from China? This one has both countervailing and anti-dumping findings.
It is indeed a double whammy. For countervailing duties, Commerce again found subsidies. A key detail here is the final affirmative determination of critical circumstances for the China-wide entity.
Critical circumstances, what's that mean?
It's significant. It means Commerce believes there was a surge in subsidized imports that would undermine the duties if they only started from the final date. Importers might rush product in before the duties hit.
So they backdate it.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Because of this finding, Commerce told Customs to suspend liquidation of these imports from March 4th, 2025, 90 days before the preliminary determination. Backdates duty collection for a stronger deterrent.
That definitely accelerates the impact. What about the anti-dumping side for the door springs?
For anti-dumping, this notice presents the preliminary results of an administrative review for certain pre-stressed concrete steel wire strand, also from China. Specific dumping margins were calculated for companies like DJJC and Ningxia Huawei, like a dollar of 41 kilograms for DJJC, $1 of 30 kilograms for Ningxia Huawei.
Indicating unfair pricing.
Right. Important note. The China-wide entity, the default for non-cooperating firms, isn't under review here, so its higher rate stays. This whole process is crucial for preventing unfair competition, but it can raise costs for U.S. consumers relying on these imports. Public comments on these prelims are invited.
From the Treasury Department, a notice of OFAC sanctions actions, publishing names added to the Specially Designated Nationals and Blocked Persons List, or SDN list, sounds like a powerful foreign policy tool.
It is a powerful and frequently used tool designed to exert significant financial pressure on individuals and entities involved in activities harmful to U.S. interests or international stability.
How does it work?
When someone's added to the SDN list, all their property and interests subject to U.S. jurisdiction are immediately blocked. U.S. persons, citizens, residents, companies are generally prohibited from transactions with them, essentially cuts off access to the U.S. financial system and many international transactions.
The source names one entity, Cooperative des Artisanos Miniers du Congo, or CDMC in the DRC. Why are they sanctioned? Feels like direct intervention.
This is where it gets insightful, highlighting efforts against illicit resource trade, especially in conflict zones. CDMC was designated August 12, 2025, under Executive Order 13413.
On what grounds?
Multifaceted. First, for being responsible for or complicit in actions threatening DRC's peace, security, or stability, specifically through the illicit trade in natural resources. This fuels conflict there. Groups fund themselves exporting minerals like coltan, tin, gold.
Okay.
Furthermore, they're sanctioned for materially assisting or providing support to an armed group called Coalition of Congolese Patriotic Resistance Force, DEFRAP, whose property was already blocked.
So cutting off funding for armed groups.
Exactly. Directly illustrates U.S. efforts to disrupt conflict financing through resource exploitation, a precise financial weapon against the economic engines of conflict and instability.
That's a profound impact, linking financial sanctions to geopolitics and human rights.
Absolutely.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, has several important notices. First, the sale of HUD FHA-owned notes, specifically reverse mortgage loans. Why is HUD selling these loans?
This is HUD managing its portfolio of assets, including distressed or non-performing loans they've acquired. They're offering a pool of reverse mortgage loans for sale to eligible private bidders.
What's the key detail for buyers?
Crucially, these loans are sold without FHA insurance and with servicing released. It means the buyer takes on full risk and responsibility for managing them. The federal insurance is gone, HUD's out of the day-to-day, helps HUD recover funds, reduces their admin burden.
And they have rules for bidders.
Yes, strict ineligibility criteria to ensure fairness and prevent conflicts of interest. For example, can't employ current HUD housing employees or use services of anyone ineligible. Prevents appearance of impropriety in selling federal assets.
Makes sense for efficient, transparent management. HUD also issued a correction to an earlier notice about carbon monoxide detection and smoke alarm requirements for the Housing Opportunities for Persons with AIDS program. Highlights the importance of accuracy and safety rules.
Indeed. Especially for critical safety measures protecting vulnerable populations. The original notice, August 5th, had incorrect compliance dates. For a population often dealing with compromised health, like those in the HOA program, working CO detectors and smoke alarms are life-saving.
Incorrect dates could be dangerous.
Exactly. Could lead to delays in installation or maintenance, exposing residents to serious risks. This correction ensures HOA pay housing providers have the precise info needed to meet these vital safety standards, shows meticulousness needed in regulations, and rapid response to fix errors, especially safety-related ones.
And finally, there's a very extensive list of Continuum of Care, COTSI RC program, awards to housing and service providers nationwide. This really feels like the core of HUD's mission in action.
This is indeed the pulse of direct homelessness assistance in the U.S., a powerful testament to federal commitment. The COSI program provides critical funding to organizations on the front lines delivering housing and support services to people experiencing homelessness.
The list is huge.
It is. The sheer volume and detail in this register edition is remarkable, spanning countless cities and states, Alabama to Wisconsin, California to Florida, underscores the immense breadth of this federal investment.
What kind of services do these awards support?
A wide array. Emergency shelters, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing for those with disabilities or chronic homelessness, outreach programs connecting with unsheltered folks.
Name specific groups.
Yes. Names organizations like Chattanooga Housing Authority, City of Huntsville, Houston Housing Authority, alongside hundreds of smaller local providers getting millions in funds. It also includes awards from FY 2023 Choice Neighborhoods Grants, Revitalizing Communities, and the FY22 ROSS program, Empowering Public Housing Residents Towards Self-Sufficiency.
So it shows the direct impact.
Exactly. This granular detail, though extensive, vividly illustrates the profound, direct impact of federal funding on communities and individuals nationwide in combating homelessness and building stronger communities, a vital social safety net, the transparency and public engagement.
The U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, has notices about agency information collection activities, specifically for the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and a Mine Development and Mineral Exploration Supplement. Seems like vital data for national strategy.
It absolutely is. Highlights a crucial but often unseen government role, gathering data for strategic national interests and informing policy. The Test Ban Treaty collection implies ongoing monitoring for international compliance vital for global security.
And the Mineral Supplement.
That's directly tied to the National Mining and Minerals Policy Acts of 1970 and 1980. USGS collects critical data from the domestic mineral industry, mineral occurrence, exploration, production, use.
What's the impact or purpose of collecting this specific mineral data, beyond just knowing what's in the ground?
This data is essential for informing Congress and policymakers about the domestic mineral industry's state. Allows them to identify potential supply crises. Imagine suddenly lacking rare earths for electronics or metals for defense.
Assessing our reliance on foreign sources.
Exactly. Crucial for economic and national security. Helps ensure resource security for critical minerals underpinning everything from smartphones to fighter jets. It's a voluntary collection from industry, by the way.
Voluntary.
Yes. The notice estimates about 45 minutes per response, 243 annual burden hours total. Shows the significant but voluntary contribution of the private sector to national resource intelligence, giving government necessary insights for decisions about vital raw materials, foundational for long-term strategy.
Makes perfect sense. Knowing what we have and need is critical. The Department of Justice, DOJ, is soliciting public comments on state laws significantly and adversely affecting the national economy or interstate commerce. Interesting asking the public to report state-level issues.
It is a fascinating exercise in identifying and addressing barriers to economic growth and free trade within our borders. DOJ is casting a wide net, inviting the public, businesses, experts, citizens to point out state laws that might unintentionally hinder interstate commerce or cause broader economic friction.
Like what kind of laws?
Maybe a state licensing requirement so onerous it stops skilled workers moving across state lines. Or a unique packaging law making it too costly for manufacturers to sell in just that state.
Creating artificial barriers.
Right. More than just identifying problems, DOJ wants suggestions for solutions. It's a unique chance for people to influence federal policy by identifying specific state regulations with broader negative economic implications. Comments due September 15th, 2025. Ground-level intelligence on economic friction points.
Really smart way to leverage public insight.
It is.
Back to the NRC. They've published a final supplemental environmental impact statement for the Point Beach nuclear plant, Units 1 and 2. Indicates ongoing scrutiny for a long-standing power source.
It does. This relates to potential subsequent license renewal, another 20 years for the Point Beach plant in Wisconsin on Lake Michigan. Nuclear plants typically get 40-year initial licenses, renewable for 20-year periods.
And this document.
The final CESS is the culmination of a thorough multi-year review. Evaluates all potential environmental impacts of extending operation for two more decades. Water use, waste management, ecological effects. It followed a robust public comment period ending June 2nd with all comments addressed in this final document.
So what is the signal?
Issuance signals that after extensive review and public input, NRC determined the environmental impacts are acceptable for extending operation. But it also underscores the ongoing rigorous public and regulatory scrutiny that accompanies nuclear energy, reflecting public concern and the industry's need for highest safety and environmental standards.
And they also issued their weekly meeting schedule, showing no public meetings for a few weeks, but an all-employees meeting on September 9th that is open to the public.
Just a clear, practical example of government transparency. Even when no public meetings are scheduled, they say so. And by listing dates and webcast details for the open all-employees meeting, they ensure public access where possible. Simple but effective open government.
Finally, several notices from the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, about proposed rule changes for various exchanges and clearinghouses, a dense but vital layer keeping our complex financial systems running smoothly and transparently.
It is indeed. The SEC's fundamental role: protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, efficient markets, facilitate capital formation. These proposed changes reflect their continuous work towards those goals in a dynamic financial landscape. They're the referees, constantly updating the rulebook.
Let's look at NASDAQ's proposed rule change first. What's that about? And why did the SEC make it effective immediately?
NASDAQ is aligning its options listing requirements with the underlying generic ETF shares listing standards. What's insightful is the commission waived the typical 30-day operative delay, making it effective immediately.
Why the rush?
Not done lightly. The reason given: it provides immediate clarity to NASDAQ's rulebook and will lead to more timely investment options and opportunities. Suggests recognizing that streamlining rules where appropriate benefits market efficiency, reduces confusion, improves investor access without compromising safety. Comments open until September 5th.
What about FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, implementing a new portal?
FINRA, overseeing broker-dealers, requires using an Office of Hearing Officers portal. This also became effective immediately. Commission determined it didn't significantly affect investor protection or competition, likely streamlines administrative processes for disputes or hearings, moves things from paper to digital, often faster, more transparent.
And the IS and BBOX exchanges, what rule changes are they proposing?
Both IS, International Securities Exchange, and BOCX, another options exchange, proposed changes to general options listing requirements, ensuring new options products can be listed efficiently. Additionally, IS has a specific rule change on options position and exercise limits.
Why are those limits important?
Crucial regulatory tools. Purpose: prevent the establishment of options positions that can be used or might create incentives to manipulate or disrupt the underlying market. Protects broader system integrity, also reduces possibility for disruption of the options market itself, especially in illiquid options where large positions could distort prices. Maintain stability and fairness. Comments for both due September 5th.
And finally, the ICC, ICE Clear Credit, has a notice. Significance of their process clarification.
ICC's notice clarifies the process for clearing new index series from the index roll date, referring to their cleared CDS products rules. important for the derivatives market, especially credit default swaps, CDS. Clearinghouses like ICC reduce systemic risk by acting as a central counterparty, guaranteeing trades even if one party defaults. Ensuring new products or series are smoothly integrated into clearing is essential for market stability and trust, especially in volatile times. Builds the infrastructure of trust in complex finance.
Our very last nugget from today's Federal Register is a notice about PENS, the Public Law Electronic Notification Service. Sounds like a great tool for staying current.
It is a simple but incredibly useful tool for anyone needing to stay on top of newly enacted federal laws. PENS is an email service notifying subscribers when a new public law is enacted. Direct, low-barrier way to get updates without constantly checking websites.
Complements the Register itself.
Exactly. Makes the legislative process more accessible. Invaluable for legal pros, policy analysts, engaged citizens. But important note, it's a mailing list only. Cannot respond to inquiries or interpret documents. One-way info delivery, but effective for staying informed.
Outro. So what does this all mean for you, our listener? We've taken a deep dive into just one day's edition of the Federal Register, Monday, August 18th, 2025. On the surface, maybe a dry bureaucratic document, but as we've seen, it is bursting with insights into the daily granular workings of our government.
Absolutely. From new FAA safety standards for innovative oxygen systems, keeping skies safe with new tech, to the DEA's rapid response to novel synthetic opioids, a frontline defense in an evolving crisis, we've explored intricate pension protection, ensuring retirements are safeguarded, and seen the Coast Guard's nimble rules for an offshore concert. Every entry reflects governance impacting you directly or indirectly.
A testament to regulation constantly evolving.
Exactly. Responding to new technologies, societal challenges, economic shifts.
You've seen how agencies like the EPA protect our food and air, and how DOJ and the SEC work to maintain economic fairness and market integrity. It's truly a complex tapestry of rules, proposed rules, notices, each with its own story and profound implications. This seemingly mundane publication is actually the living record of how our government responds.
This raises an important question for you, our listener. Given the incredible breadth and depth of the Federal Register and the actions we've discussed today, from airport safety to pension stability, chemical regulation to combating homelessness, what single area of government action do you think has the most significant yet often overlooked impact on your daily life? Something you rarely think about, but which fundamentally shapes your world.
We hope this deep dive has given you a newfound appreciation for the detailed, often hidden, but absolutely vital work of federal agencies keeping our society functioning. Join us next time for another journey into the depths of knowledge. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Taylor Johnson.
Thanks for tuning in to The Deep Dive.